When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Marvel Movie Talk. As always, I am Christian Blatt, down low in what is essentially the center square, our own Jim J. Bullock, David Brody. Thank you for being here. And we've got Logan full screen up top, which we'll be sharing some images of Logan momentarily, actually. But of course, Eric Connor and our pal Nate Miller was having some vehicular issues, so he won't be with us today. We will see if anyone else pops on today. That'll be great if they do. If not, we are going to hold down the fort, and we are going to spend our time talking about X-Men 97 Episode 7, Bright Eyes. But first, before we get to that, I do want to talk a little bit about the Deadpool and Wolverine trailer, the latest Deadpool and Wolverine trailer. And, you know, I was very recently saying to a group of people that I was thinking of maybe not watching it because, you know, I don't want the movie to get spoiled. But then I'm like, but I do this show, so I feel like I need to at least talk about it. And in all honesty, I think that this doesn't really give anything away. There's like an image, but for the most part. So obviously, we're just showing it in the background for our video audience. But what are either of your thoughts? And if either of you have not seen the latest trailer, feast your eyes on the images, but no sounds that we're getting here. But I'll start with Eric. I assume you saw this trailer already.
Of course, it's hard to avoid it, and yeah. I didn't try. I mean, this is our big Marvel film for 2024. So,
true.
And it's also, I mean, obviously, the chemistry that these two actors have, even in like the commercials they've done, and their sort of back and forth on X, aka Twitter. I mean, they're a great pairing. I mean, this is like something. Yeah. I think we've all talked a lot about, like, give us more pairings, give us more sort of mini teams. That's kind of a nice way forward for Marvel. So I think pairing the two of these guys will be, you know, it's a brilliant move. This ad, though, looked more emotional. It's funny, it's like the last one was so kind of goofy. And this one has some references to, was it like whiskey? What do you call it? Whiskey blades?
Whiskey claws. Yeah.
Whiskey claws.
And yeah. Yeah, image that went viral, the Liefeld's Just Feet shoe store that you can
terrific.
See above at the moment. I love that level of inside baseball. Yeah, look, I don't think this gives a lot away. The little snippets that I was reading from what people saw at CinemaCon gave a lot away, like the first 9 minutes or whatever it was they showed them. But this is fun. What do you think of this, Brody? And I will bring our fourth in a moment when Mr. Brody shares his thoughts.
I loved it. I tell you, I love the inside jokes. The feet joke was tremendous. I loved the highlight for me was that for most of the trailer, Wolverine does not have sleeves, which is something they had not shown previously because Hugh Jackman was covering his arms to not get sun poisoning at some point. So they're like, all right, he's going to have sleeves, but Wolverine doesn't have sleeves. So the fact that he no longer has them, I assume one got ripped as he ripped them both off or something. So that was great. What amazes me is this is a trailer. They showed so much, which means how much more are they not showing? Right.
Oh, there's an infinite amount that we're not seeing.
Right. Them, so. If they're going to throw out the Ant-Man, the giant Ant-Man, the dead giant Ant-Man from Quantumania, and they're going to show the Doctor Strange portal, you know, then my God, what are they not showing us?
Yeah, right. Exactly. I want to bring our fourth today, Gina Polito. Gina, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So we are talking about
taking off the jacket.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. That's
because it's serious now.
Gina's ready to work. we're going to dive into X-Men 97 episode 7 in a moment, but we wanted to start off talking about the Deadpool and Wolverine trailer. And did you have any thoughts other than, you know, just sort of it's a lot of visuals. It's a lot of flash. They don't give away a lot of substance, I think, for the movie. It's my favorite kind of trailer, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, I saw a couple people online that were pissed because Easter egg hunters were breaking down the cameos. Because there are so many old X-Men cameos in there. Right. And I love that. I love that stuff because I think that means that whatever is in the actual movie is going to be even better than those, you know, it's got to be better than just like Pyro and Callisto are here. I think we're in for a treat. So I love when they're like, hey, here are some Easter eggs, because then, you know, it's whatever is left in is going to be even better.
Yeah, it makes you think of Spider-Man No Way Home. The trailers is like, oh, man, there's a lot of stuff in there. And then you go and see it. It's like, oh, my God, look at what wasn't in there. So very excited for this. My only regret was when I first tried to watch the trailer, it was some site. I don't know if it was Hollywood Reporter or Entertainment Weekly. It was a beeped version of the trailer. So I stopped watching that. And then I typed in the words red band. And then I got the one that I wanted. We were talking about the inside joke that our visual audience sees right there. The Liefeld's Just Feet shoe store, which I think got so that it was trending. Our old buddy Zach Wilson texted me from an earlier iteration of this show. He was very excited to see that. I'll tell you one place it didn't play well was a Facebook group I'm in, which is a Rob Liefeld fan group. And somebody shared it. And I'm just thinking, why would you share that? And then you watch the reactions. You're like, oh, okay, that's why they did it. You know,
but like also, he's always in on the joke. They made that same joke in Deadpool 2 when Deadpool goes on his rant about probably some sicko who can't draw feet.
Can't draw feet.
Yeah, exactly. Liefeld made a cameo in the first one. So he apparently is delighted by it. I don't know why he's in on it,
but I think a lot of people were trying to white knight Rob Liefeld and stand up for him when maybe he doesn't need it. And, it was one of those that whoever did post it, I was like, okay, some people just want to watch the world burn, as a great man once said. Gina, it's your first time with us. And before we dive into episode 7, give us your thoughts on the first, well, really, it's more than the first half of the season. What had come before this? I noticed you posting an awful lot about it on Twitter and other social media, and we hadn't talked in years. You were one of the directors for a show at Upright Citizens Brigade called Sketch Cram, where the writers get together in the morning, and I was taking a sketch writing class there at the time. And you get together in the morning, you write some sketches, and then by the afternoon you figure out what's going up, and it goes up that night at midnight. It's a very fun, long, intense day. I don't know, it was 6-7 years ago, but I saw you writing about X-Men. I'm like, I know a show for Gina to jump on.
I love it. I've been freelance writing for new rock stars for a while. They break down Easter eggs for different movies and stuff. So I had rewatched all 5 seasons of the original and broke them down into like a massive, you know, hour long breakdown of everything you need to know, and sort of the best like one or two Easter eggs from every single episode from the original. So I was ready for this. I admit I didn't expect it to be this good. I mean, I knew it was going to be great. The original was great. I didn't realize how mature it was going to be and how hard they were going to go straight out of the gate. But I love it. I think that we're all going to be collectively absolutely crushed with what's to come.
I think you're absolutely right. And there's a lot of shapes and sizes for reboots and revivals. I'm always afraid whenever there's one that it'll be the Spike TV revival of Ren and Stimpy that was very short-lived. And it was like, it was missing everything except for Billy West getting a big paycheck, which that I respect. But I was just like, oh, anything that made the show fun is gone now. And I worried, you know, when it was Disney Plus was doing this, and I've been pleasantly surprised. I will admit to everyone in our audience and all of our hosts, I was expecting us to do a lot more doubling up, where it's like, okay, well, every other week we'll do two episodes. And even before we got to episode five, I realized like, we don't need to do that. Even though it's a half hour show, there's still so much to talk about. So we'll dive in specifically to Bright Eyes, which is episode seven. No licensing of Bonnie Tyler for the episode, but I think it's also unnecessary. I will ask you first, Mr. Brody. Because of you as our, I don't want to call you our resident curmudgeon, but you sometimes sprinkle some of that energy on us because you stopped reading the X-Men about Uncanny 210. You hadn't previously watched this, but you love the characters. So you bring a slightly different view on these things. As for those of us watching can see you, the way that Sasquatch is just kind of peeking into your... there's the whole team. That's I wonder how much John Byrne got for the sale of that T-shirt. But what did you think of episode seven, Mr. Brody?
Well, I first want to come clean and let you know that right after this podcast, my second favorite podcasters on YouTube is New Rock Stars. So I watch three videos a day every night. I'm very familiar with your work. So I'm honored to have you on our podcast because I'm obsessed. I'm not Eric, but I do my best. So I very much enjoy your breakdowns.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm actually right after this going to be on the break room over at New Rock Stars. So I doubled up on X-Men content today.
I have to apologize to Gina. I didn't know I was putting you in a room with a potential stalker. My apologies.
Yeah, little bit.
I wouldn't use the word potential.
Well, he's in New Jersey, so it's going to make it difficult.
Okay, I'm not a stalker.
I'm from New Jersey, so
even though Gina is the Miss Small Young Girl Chess Champion of New Jersey or something. So.
Yep, I go back frequently, so it wouldn't be that hard to stalk me.
to know.
Before the two of you start talking about the distinction between 732 and 908, why don't we dive in to the reaction from Mr. Brody of episode 7.
All right, very good, very good. I loved it. First of all, I liked that it wasn't a split episode. There wasn't a secondary story that kept popping up in the middle. I liked that it was all just the story that needed to be told post-massacre. So that I very much enjoyed. I don't like what they're doing with Wolverine's character. It seems like he's making puns and jokes when he should be violently threatening people. You know, like they're like, oh, we have to get this guy. Yeah, we're going to do some damage. Like he's not violent Wolverine. He's not like, let's go kill people. So that's that. And we talked about how he's been diminished on this show. He really has done nothing.
Although I appreciated that they were doing it in spite of that, but, I think he's got like one poignant line in this episode where I think is just reminding us of his character. And it's, you know, basically to jump way ahead. It's after Rogue does something, he's like, yeah, she did what we all wanted to do.
Right.
You know? So yeah, it's like, all right, but you're right. For the most part, he's kind of been window dressing, you know?
Right.
So,
and I thought there was more than that. There was a scene at the front where he had an opportunity to be very upset about what happened. And he sort of made a play on words. Like he was like being comic relief instead of Wolverine. So other than that, you know, it's good to see who the villain is. You know, I'm sure we'll talk more about that. I think I did like Rogue's Street Fighter kick. If you caught that. So overall, I enjoyed the episode. It's nice seeing Captain America, although he doesn't fly. I'm not sure how he gets his shield back. So.
I mean, you know. Perhaps you didn't see him running around Washington, D.C.
Oh, he can do that all day, clearly. Yeah.
So he'll do it all day. He will go pick up that shield out of the snow all day.
Not a problem. Yeah, okay.
Gina, what did you think specifically about where the story took us in episode 7, Bright Eyes?
I really enjoyed it. I think that this is kind of what would be called back in the day of actual like seasons of shows that had more than eight episodes. This would kind of be a little bit of a filler episode, even though it was packed with stuff. But I appreciated it. I think it sort of let our brains rest a little bit. Same with the last episode. I think, you know, we need a break, and the showrunner has said that these next three episodes are his favorite, and also just recently tweeted out that everyone should rewatch One Man's Worth, which was one of my favorite two-part arcs from the original series. So I think that we will be getting more based on that, and that alone, I think we'll be getting more Wolverine, because that was, those were big Wolverine episodes. And yeah, so I really enjoyed it. I kind of loved all the nods to, you know, a new villain sort of calling the old villains, you know, pussies, for lack of a better word. Like, he was like, I'm here. You guys never got it right. So now I'm taking over. And I sort of love that badass reveal of like, oh, whatever you thought this was going to be. Some of us, you know, had correctly guessed that who this was going to be, but I think other people were expecting it to sort of be the same villains from the original show. And this guy came along and was like, it's not.
Yeah, I think that to your point, you know, Mr. Sinister has always been held up as this badass. And he's like, the only thing you are is a sinister bitch. Get out of my way. You know, basically. Now, that is not what he said, but his body language spoke volumes. Before we dive into the specifics, Eric, I want to get your overall thoughts on this.
It's funny you say it's a filler episode, which, you know, I guess technically it is, because it's a bridge into now. Here's our new bad. And yet there was so much in this, like you were saying. Rogue's story in this was fabulous. And I even like Captain America shows up for, I don't know, a brief discussion. And then she's like, all right, go get your shield. Bye. And she leaves. And I'm like, wow, that's. Talk about reverting an expectation with a cameo. Like,
yeah, by the way, that was definitely the go get your fucking shine box moment to
most
Rogers. Yeah.
No, Captain America fans, I think, would be even more upset than the feet comments, because right, he showed up and did nothing. But I just thought top to bottom, her episode was great. And it was also kind of a fun investigative piece. She's, you know, hunting for Trask. And then, of course, the choice she makes at the end. I thought her whole episode was awesome. And it's funny, too, because the beginning is actually really somber. Like, they take their time with Barry and Gambit. And I kept wondering, I was like, man, they really aren't giving Magneto much of anything on this. And then, of course, there's a reveal why. I was like, man,
there wasn't a memorial. There wasn't a statue. There wasn't even a Zoom funeral everybody, you know, from the parking lot of Gambit's tapped
all
in.
I agree. All these beautiful words about Gambit. And, you know, Gambit was a man. He always did the safe bet was, in fact, his humanity and Magneto. Thank you. And that was it. And I was like, wow. Right.
It's the old Gilligan's Island and the rest, basically.
Right.
Let's go through, since you've latched onto that part of it, we'll sort of chronologically talk about. I love any time they acknowledge, whether it's on screen or in print, Kurt's faith. And I thought, you know, I was glad that I'm glad for just how much of him we've gotten this year. He's always been one of my favorites and always will be. I'm a very big Kurt Wagner fan. And Cammy Egan in the chat, I want Nightcrawler to give my eulogy when I die. Well, I hope that you outlive Kurt Wagner by many, many years, but maybe you could get him to record a cameo.
Or Alan Cumming, at least.
I mean, who doesn't want Alan Cumming reading at their funeral? You know what? I'm going to go check and see if he's on Cameo after this, and I'll give Alan Cumming whatever the cost is. But it is very somber, and I like sort of the idea of saying things about Gambit that they probably never did while he was still alive. I mean, they don't in this show, and Gina, you just rewatched it recently. I don't think they really deal with the depths of which, you know, the sins of Gambit that we saw in the comics. Am I correct in that recollection, or do they have him kind of, you know, having been a well, not an ally, but somebody working for Sinister at one point? I actually don't remember the original series well enough that I want to say that.
Yeah, no, he never does. There's nothing as dark as him sort of like being involved in the destruction of Genosha. The closest they come is an episode called Externally Yours, which is he goes back to the bayou with the, you know, for an annual tithe of a very, very early 90s creature. And they sort of deal with the fact that, like, yes, he used to be a thief, you know, in the Thieves Guild, and there are assassins. And at the end of the episode, he sort of makes this declaration of, like, I am neither thief, I'm not an assassin, I'm an X-Man. And that's sort of his moment of being like, yeah, I've done some crap, but not anymore.
Yeah, because I mean, in the comics, it's so brutal. There's like, it's like, oh yeah, so if you want to kill the Morlocks, this is the way you come in. Yeah, just go ahead and just plow through here. How much am I getting for this? All right, I'm gonna go. You know, and it's I mean, it's some great character work, him dealing with that and trying to make up for it. But I don't know how well that flies on even Disney Plus, even though this isn't Saturday morning anymore. But I thought that, and I'm sorry, but I am still in no way convinced that we won't have Gambit back on the show at some point. You know, I thought that maybe we were going to be heading in a Krakoa direction this season. I don't think it's this season. You know, no one stays dead, even in the X-Men, you know, so I will be surprised if we never get him again. I will have to tip my hat if he stays dead, even for all of, let's say, if he stays dead of all of season two. I'll ask you first, Gina. Do you think that Remy LeBeau is going to be back at some point in this show, or do you hope that they actually make his death matter?
I think he will be back. I'm 99.9% sure he'll be back. I think there's a few different ways that they can do it, some of which are laid out in the comics. I also would love if he does. I would love it if they don't bring him back until season two. I think they might bring him back in the season one finale. That's my prediction.
Yeah, I mean, they couldn't even let Morph stay dead, and we weren't even really attached to him. You know, I mean, in the original series. I thought that all that stuff was nice, and you know, we definitely got to see some of our cameos were at that part of the episode, you know, and we saw the little memorial to Callisto and Leech, and you know, just a lot of characters that we got to see. In fact, our friend Eric has gotten the character who turned into the parrot, and I'm actually not sure who that was.
An original character for the,
Okay.
For the
series.
I'm hoping is the next spinoff, honestly, because I had so many questions about the parrot.
I believe she had to fly back to the Enchanted Tiki Room where she had a show that she was supposed to sing in 5 minutes later, if I had to guess.
I thought she was from Aladdin. It was like one of the...
With a new voice.
Yeah, and if you ever saw that bird tell the aristocrat story, then...
Hey, speaking of death, I don't know if you saw that Bo, the creator of the show, I forget his whole name.
Bo DeMeo, yeah.
Bo DeMeo said that Madeline Pryor is definitely dead.
Oh, all right.
He did an interview a couple of days ago. He said she's dead, which I'm like, oh, so you unveiled her and you killed her. So
I mean, I think the fact that the fact that Cable comes back and he's like, I'm sorry, Mom. I think this is not his first rodeo trying to save her. And I think it won't be his last. I think she will also be back.
Yeah. I think Cable showing up, this is, you know, this is his, like, I don't know, last half hour of, what was that movie? Edge of Tomorrow, where you just keep trying. I think that this is the time Cable gets it right. And that might be when we see Madeline. That might be when we see Gambit again. That was, Brody, you were early in on that theory that,
just come back 5 minutes earlier.
Yeah. Right.
But, you know, nobody, every time we say nobody dies, I have to just remember poor Thunderbird because he's dead. He's like, every X-Men comes back with Thunderbird. They gave us his brother.
His brother's around,
His brother wore the same outfit. They're like, oh, here's Thunderbird again. We made James and John, but they never brought Thunderbird back. So every time you say everybody comes back, I'm like, no, not Thunderbird. Who, by the way, was pulling out for Thunderbird. When he died, you know, there was an uproar. Like, you created this Native American character and you killed him by his third comic. You'd think that would be somebody you'd bring back. Someone like who people cared about. Nope. No Thunderbird. So
he was actually supposed to be the original one killed in the instead of Morph in the original series. And then they realized, well, we might get some backlash for this. So they created Morph to kill him.
Yeah.
Right. Which I think that's the move, you know?
Yeah. So my point is every time Christian says no X-Men dies, just remember there's an asterisk there.
I am sure that at some point he came back. I would have to really dig through. I can't imagine he stayed dead in X-Men 95 and never showed up again.
I looked it up. Nothing.
All right.
Don't make me go to Reddit. I don't want to go there.
You don't want to go to Reddit. No, no. Especially not while we're trying to focus on the show. Okay. But so that's the one. But I'm saying, you know, Jean died for like 5 years our time in the real world, and that was about it. So, but you know, everyone essentially comes back. You know, Charlie's coming back. We knew he wasn't dead, except Thunderbird. Yeah, everyone except Thunderbird. And I think they realized correctly. Chris Claremont realized is like, oh, he's the same character as Wolverine. This one's more interesting. So, but. You know, he didn't, nobody wanted to have Sunfire around, so they just had him leave. You didn't have to kill him, you know. Sunfire was just an asshole. Every time you see Sunfire, he's an asshole. Nobody wants him around. But, you don't want to actually go and kill him. All right, so we have sort of that somber stuff, and I thought that there was a great interaction. I was excited a few episodes ago, the first time we saw Hank, the Beast, talking to Trish Tilby, the TV reporter whom he had a fairly long relationship with in the comics. And I thought that they had a very meaningful conversation. You know, it was very deep. And, you know, there was some sense of betrayal in there, which I don't blame him. What did you think sort of about, I got to ask you first, Gina, what did you think about Hank's sort of handling, you know, the fact that this reporter's there, and you know, he's clearly very angry at her. It just takes him a little while to work up to it.
Yeah, I think she deserved it. I think like of all the things to say in that moment, just stick with platitudes, lady. Like just you know, ask him, what can I do to help? Do you want a sandwich? Is there like, what can I do? Instead of launching into this, like, well, I think it's like, of course that's not going to go over well. I think in different times, maybe Beast sort of been like, yeah, you've got a really good point. But when surrounded with the dead, not the smartest time to sort of try and steer the conversation towards politics.
Yeah, Eric, Beast is usually kind of the most thoughtful and calm, you know, which I think is done intentionally as direct contrast to the appearance of the character. What did you think about what Hank had to say in the early part of this episode?
Well, and as a Harry professor myself, I relate to Beast quite well. I think his words were really impactful, but also there was a moment, I'm not sure if you could bring up the image, Christian, but like, when they're covering the tent where the wounded / dead are. And even that kind of moment, when once the press arrived, like they kind of understand, like, we don't want this to turn into another. Yeah. This moment here, I thought was like, this moment really got me. Actually, I was surprised. I know it sort of goes back to what we're saying, like what would Disney show and not show, but I thought this was such a telling visual in the next, I don't have the next image, but the next one was just, him covering so we don't see it. And I think, you know, I mean, this section here very much spoke to so much of right now and really kind of stung in a way that, again, thinking back to reading X-Men as a kid, you know, like this idea of you'd find there's always something happening in those pages relevant to something happening in life. And they don't shy away from the hard stuff. It's the thing that makes X-Men, for me, still to this day, the most fascinating comic book, the most fascinating kind of world within the world of the MCU, the world of Marvel Comics, was always these guys because they go there. And, you know, I liked seeing Beast getting a little more beasty, a little more angry. He's not always going to be the one who's just thinking with his intellect, but rather his emotions bubbling to the surface a bit more in this one.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, the calm, somber piece to be getting, you know, the character always, you know, whether it's in the comics, but one of the great usages of him in the original series is, you know, sort of the quotes that he has. And I mean, he gives some tremendous quotes in this episode. And one of them was, it was hard to not be moved by a little bit. He quoted the great Fred Rogers, which is look for the helpers. Yes. And I wasn't expecting that. It's usually like, well, you know, he's like in King Lear, you know, Act Four, you know, it's usually a little bit more like that. And it's like, oh yeah, that's one I actually knew. You know, obviously appropriate to the sentiment of that moment. I mean, I remember those comments from Fred Rogers after 9/11, you know, so it's, you know, none of them. There's one from Martin Luther King later in the episode. Everything was, we hit the perfect note, you know, and I thought that they did a great job. There is definitely a filler feeling to this episode, but it's almost like, We needed this episode. They made us wait an extra week for it because of everything that happened last week. But it was like, yeah, let's deal with this aftermath. David, I want to get your thoughts about sort of this part of the episode. You know, we've buried Gambit. We've got Beast just sort of really surveying, and he's actually angry.
The Mr. Rogers quote was perfect for me, especially with the 9/11 reference you just made, because
sure.
Post this attack, there were memorials set up for lost people, the same way there were, you know, at Ground Zero. There yeah. were searching for signs, you know, looking for this person or that person. And it definitely hit me as you know, like what Ground Zero looked like. People were, you know, looking through the rubble and looking for survivors and laying out the dead. You know, it was powerful for me. And I know, I don't think it was meant to be, but the shot you're showing right now reminded me of the Twin Towers, because you had these two giant statues that were symbolic and they were laying there with the skyline between them. And that's what I thought of.
I would hazard a guess that it's not accidental. I think that they knew very much sort of the parallels. And, you know, Eric touched on it before. A lot of the dialogue in this episode and the grief people are dealing with, it hits a lot closer to the headlines than the creators of the show ever would have imagined when they started working on it like 3-4 years ago, you know. So I think it's great that this is, yes, this is still a cartoon. It's still Disney. Yes, but it's able to have more adult themes than anything else. You know, I mean, this is far more sophisticated storytelling than they would have even been able to accomplish in 1992, the original series, which I think had plenty to, you know, sort of tip your hat to. But this is, you know, really, and as Cam Egan says, it's a comparison. I mean, they want us to understand, you know, that's what this is to the mutants. That, you know, that lived through it, or even, you know, those watching back from the X mansion. So I think it was great to take the time to really just kind of sit in this and just deal with it. And then just the frustration that we continue to get out of Scott Summers, whom, as our buddy Jordan Bloom has been saying and referenced even when he was on the show, we're getting very close to the ultimate Cyclops that he wants to see. And we'll see if that's the case that we get. But just his frustration speaking with President Kelly. I think that it's a very real world conversation, Eric, that he has, which is, you know, the optics are bad, and it's like, look, you need me to still be here, because if I get replaced, it's going to be somebody that's not so tolerant. You know, even there, you know, Scott's talking about times like this are when dreaming matters most. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are, Eric, on sort of that interaction between Scott and the president.
Well, one, the moment that I was so fascinated by Scott crying, yeah, and how they actually took a real moment with that, because yeah, you know, this idea like he has to dry his eyes, but also you know, you accidentally knock that visor the wrong way and all of a sudden bad things happen. You
that's
know?
A great and, point. Yeah, yeah.
And that kind of sums up so much of him, right? Is like this idea of like, I don't have the luxury to cry. Like when you're a leader sometimes. And you know, we've had in our lifetime various leaders here and the ones who could cry and what that meant. And so that was one of those moments that sort of, I don't know, sometimes you see something and you just read deep into it. And that one moment that they really took, you know, it wasn't just a quick cutaway. It was like, it was a shot and then a close up of it as well. You know, Cyclops's journey into what he could become is one that is exciting for me as a fan, not just of the X-Men, but really a fan of Cyclops. You know, I know before, Brody, you were talking about, like, you know, Wolverine sort of been really in the backseat of the show, if not the back, or the way back, as we called it back in the day of the station wagons. But I do think having Cyclops at the center, I mean, you know, he's trying to figure out, how do I continue this legacy? It looked like Magneto was going to do it, but now Magneto's seemingly out of the picture until he gets a nice shave. We're not really sure then, like, does this mean Cyclops is still going to be leading? And so I think, like, that's something for the next three episodes should be fascinating, especially because we know who's still coming back, and that's Storm. And when she comes back, it feels like she'll be the natural replacement, although Professor X is still out there.
Well, exactly. So, that's what I was going to say. Both Storm and Charles are both coming back. So
right,
yeah,
right. So we're not sure where that's going to leave Cyclops. And you could really strongly see in this episode this sort of break within the X-Men. You know, that moment when Rogue does her thing, which we haven't gotten to just yet. But like Morph's
don't worry, response. We will.
Oh, I know. But Morph's response to that, I think that one line is so important because it really is saying, like, okay, which side are you on? Which gets back to, of course, Magneto and Charles Xavier's rift. It's like, how do we handle these things? Are we going to be more MLK or Malcolm X?
Right. And I think that's a comparison that is often drawn between Xavier and Magneto. And it could not be more apt. Gina, I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on sort of this aspect of the episode and each of the little scenes that we're talking about that sort of feed into this part of the narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what everyone is saying here. I do think that, like, bringing up Charles right now is interesting because we have two of the strongest mutants still out there that have not sort of come back and dealt with all of this. I think that, you know, the fact that we haven't seen them in an episode is very telling that they're going to bring them back in some big way. And you know, like a you don't usually see a pissed off Charles. I mean, talk about a pissed off Beast. You don't usually see a pissed off Charles. And when he's pissed, I think he can go to some places. Same with Storm. I think they're two of the most, other than Beast, probably two of the most reserved characters. There's a whole storyline in the original about Storm, you know, letting loose and losing control and blah, blah, blah. And I think the fact that we didn't see them at all this episode means that when they come back, it is going to be with a bang, maybe even more so than Storm's entrance in season one, in episode one. So I'm very much looking forward to that. I also think that, you know, everything that people have been saying about 9/11, I think is very, very on point. I think, you know, Bo DeMeo has tweeted a few things about also the Pulse nightclub shooting, which he had in mind when writing this and when writing, you know, everything.
Yeah,
that happened.
We read that post from him or part of it. And the early part of Genosha was supposed to be, you know, before the incident in episode 5, he's like, yeah, that's exactly what it was like. That's what it felt to those of us who went to that nightclub. And I'm glad you circled back to that because I had forgotten that specifically was something that he wanted to touch on, Gina.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's all in there. I think it gives someone from sort of every generation, the tragedies of each generation. It gives them all something to sort of relate to. which is terrible, but you know.
No, and I mean, and we talked about the, you know, just how appropriate and fitting and logical it was that in episode five, Magneto's flashing back to the Holocaust, which in this iteration of the character, he's still lived through and has all those memories. So, yeah, I think that, again, it really is, you know, this grown-up, sophisticated storytelling that people who read the X-Men should expect. Not, again, not that the original animated series didn't have it, but it's another example of like, oh, wow, they really go for it more than I thought they would. Cammy Egan, I love how the show touches on real-world themes, and the X-Men are trying to deal with the prejudices. I think that the many different creators involved with the X-Men have done a great job of taking the idea of mutant and anti-mutant sentiment being an allegory for racism, you know, anti-Semitism, basically, you know, anti-gay. You know, it's like it can. It's really all encompassing. It's like yes, it's all of that because these people are super powered, and I think that we're getting to see a lot of it. There was one thing. Here we go. Daniel Drew, this was a slightly different comment. I hope we don't get Beast being more like his modern comic version, who is just frustrating. You know, everything's on the table, I have to say. They have pulled at threads that I wasn't expecting them to. We talked about episode five being reminiscent of E is for Extinction, the Grant Morrison arc, which I just don't think of them, you know, jumping around the actual comic book timeline the way that they have. So before we talk about Rogue, I want to talk about which was essentially the C story for this episode. And I'll start with you, Gina. I love the inclusion of Sunspot this season, Roberto da Costa, who we've still barely seen use his powers. And just sort of because it ties into this theme of, you know, Yeah, we knew you were a mutant, but now we have to be quiet about it. And I was like, oh, yeah, that, I mean, it's straight out of the comics, but it's also like, we also haven't seen his dad yet. His, Roberto's dad was never seen as a sympathetic character, you know? So give us your thoughts sort of on, you know, Roberto's coming to term with, yeah, I should tell my family, you know, and Jubilee really making, you know, an impassioned plea of like, do you want your parents to find out, you know, when they're hearing that you're dead, that you were mutant, you know? What were your thoughts on how they told that part of the story, Gina?
Yeah, I think it's interesting how they've sort of updated the coming out narrative. I think, you know, in the original 90s run, a lot of the characters had told their parents, and you know, Rogue's dad essentially disowned her and said, you know, no kid of mine is gonna be a mutant. And I think that to a younger audience, an audience today, that sort of doesn't ring quite as true anymore. And I'm not at all saying that parents don't parents react great and everything is puppies and roses. I just think that I like that they updated it to, you know, okay, yeah, we already knew. And then they hit you with the gut punch of, so how are we going to keep it quiet? You have to adjust your... Yeah. So it's a different kind of gut punch than you know, Rogue's dad sort of screaming at her and kicking her out. It's almost more insidious because it's sort of under the guise of, oh yes, we totally support you, but never in public and never, you know, if it affects us negatively. So I appreciate the fact that they updated a little bit for 2024. And I just really like how he's the new Jubilee. He is what Jubilee was in the original series, and she's his guide along this journey because she's the character who most recently went through it, because in this world it is just a continuation of the 90s series. It's not set in 2024. So she would have just fairly recently gone through the whole her foster parents realizing she's a mutant, dealing with it herself, being accepted by this you know, family of X-Men, and you know, sort of being treated a certain way and treated like a little kid. So I appreciate the fact that the show didn't want to retread on her story, and now she's able to get a little bit of closure herself for what she went through by passing on her very stressful, like learned knowledge from the original series.
Yeah, I think it's important to keep in mind this is the 90s Jubilee. This Jubilee is very far off from, you know, being a vampire pregnant with a little werewolf or vampire baby. It's hard to keep track. But there was a great line on the screen that I actually zoomed out of. I zoomed in on the image. But what she said was, you don't want your parents to bury a stranger. And again, that's just, you know, some very deep conversation. This is a much more grown up Jubilee than I think we got in the 92 series, but it not in the way where you feel like, oh, this isn't the same character. It's just, you know, she's seen a lot through those seasons. What did you think about this interaction, David? This idea of the parents are accepting, but, you know, only up to a point.
Well, I think it's typical. It's typical for many parents who, you know, they accept you, but quietly, right? Like, yeah, okay, we get that you're dropping out of college. Just don't tell anybody, right? We appreciate your decision, but we're not going to call up the family and tell them, oh, yeah, Mike's great. He dropped out of college, but he's great. You're just going to keep it a secret. And much like when you come out to your parents.
Or possibly in your household, we can't tell anyone that you are pursuing a career in morning radio.
That's correct.
We can't say that. Yeah.
Right. You were supposed to go to law school. What happened?
Yeah, exactly. It's.
I think Gina's comparison of Sunspot becoming the new Jubilee is actually right out of the opening credits, because they replaced Jubilee running to the fence with Sunspot running to the fence. They actually replaced one with the other. They made him the new Jubilee by putting him in our scene. He's the new Kitty Pryde, I guess you'd say, right? For this generation.
Yeah.
And the father was always an ass, you know? So I did note that she said, we always knew when our houses burned down, you know, we always knew, right? We didn't want to bring it up. I wonder if she's saying that oh, your dad and I are on the same page. I can't think that Roberta, the senior, is on the same page. I think it's going to be drama when he, you know.
If he is on the same page, he's a completely rewritten character from
right
on the pages of New Mutants. I agree. What do you think, Eric? You know, you shared this image with me, and then also the one we just showed of his mother saying that shareholders are rattled by anything mutant related.
Yeah, and Jeannie brought up such a great point that, like, it is, you know, even if the story is set towards the back end of the 90s, we as an audience are in 2024. And so to do a scene like you would have in the 90s wouldn't hit us in the same way. It wouldn't feel maybe quite as emotionally accurate to what a lot of people go through. And this scene I thought was so well written, because there's a great, to use that wrestling term again, a heel turn, where she starts off with the a mother knows, and you're like, oh my gosh, and it totally went differently than you expected. You thought it was going to be the moment in X-Men 2, even the have you ever tried not being a mutant, and it doesn't go there. Yeah. And then that great line about how shareholders are rattled by mutant related stuff, so that, and cutting deeper, not dismissing you because of faith, not dismissing you because of a belief, but rather saying, I love you, but I love our image more. I love our business more. I love our money more. And I am ashamed of you without saying it. Yeah. It was such a powerful moment. And I think does speak to, I think, more of what a lot of people deal with in 2020s. It's that idea of, like, I'm okay with something when it's like over there, but when right. It's here, I don't know how quite to handle it. And then it becomes a thing always. You know, you kind of lead with that when describing certain family members. And so, yeah, this scene, I think, was great. I like that they handled it with this sort of, you know, both in some ways subtlety, but also with, like, really getting into that mom as a character. I could see her coming back. Like, she really, like, they set her up as a potentially great thorn in the side of the X-Men down the road. So. Yeah, no, it was just one of those pitch perfectly written scenes, and got me excited for more of Sunspot, because they tease us with him. I want him at least to have a shirt with his own name, since Jubilee has earrings with her name. Like, I just think whoever's the new kid, should be labeled accordingly.
Let's just say if those earrings aren't for sale at Comic-Con, somebody has not read the room. It would be great if they're giving them away, but let's
Christian, you and I are buying a 3D printer and we're going to make bank.
We're going to start an Etsy shop. We'll tell you where to do that. Craig Robinson asking a funny question of Eric, is Roberto's mom the new banker from Falcon and Winter Soldier? I don't believe that any character will ever achieve the level of the banker. I want to obviously finish talking up on Rogue and some of the other big things. There's just a couple of moments in the episode. The diamond transmutation of Emma Frost, which is a later addition to the character, was something featured. And I have to say, I was very excited to see two characters. One was Strong Guy, which I think we'd seen him in the background before, but there he was. Mm-hmm. He actually had a line this time. So I was very excited to see him.
Well, great name for a hero, by the way.
Well, it's soon part of the whole thing. Man. It's the whole part of the thing that he's Strong Guy. Yeah, his name was Guido for a long time, and then they decided that's not really. Yeah, well, I think so. But I was also excited to see Thunderbolt Ross, not voiced by Harrison Ford, by the way. But maybe they'll fix it. By the way, Captain America, voiced by Josh Keaton, who does all the voices for Captain America and What If, and I'm not sure what else, but definitely What If. So I was the nerd who freeze framed the credits, and I wanted to make sure that I was.
Well, I did that too for Bastion. I was I thought for a second sounded to me like Nathan Fillion, and it's not. I totally thought it was, and I'm like, whoever this actor is, by the way, that dude's amazing. So I'm excited about just hearing him again.
You just revealed yourself as not a White Lotus watcher.
Aha! I watched season one. Was he season two? Oh,
season two is vastly superior.
All right. That's my homework. I'm sorry.
That's the first time I've heard that, Gina. But I understand that it's not like saying season two of True Detective is the one to watch.
They're barely connected, the seasons of White Lotus. He is Theo James is fantastic in that, and I was very excited trying to figure out what role he was going to have in this show.
So let's talk about Rogue and getting to see her. It was Daniel was the one who mentioned it again. Thank you, Daniel. Daniel, I'm afraid you had said you were driving to work. I hope that when you send these messages, you're at a red light. Please don't be on the highway. We love hearing from you, but I worry about you, Daniel. In any case, I didn't know. He didn't play the game, but a lot of Rogue's actions in this episode were taken from Marvel vs. Capcom. And that's something that I think, Eric, you mentioned. But let's talk about getting to see this Rogue, this angry Rogue. This Rogue, by the way, being very reminiscent of the first iteration of the character, before she was taken in by Charles Xavier because she couldn't control her powers. The Brotherhood of Evil Mutants Rogue is fairly consistent. The I'm going to steal Carol Danvers' powers Rogue.
Did you catch the Easter egg? The license plate of Captain America's motorcycle was AVG-10, which refers to Avengers Annual 10, which was Rogue's first appearance where she took Ms. Marvel's powers.
Damn. Correct. Yeah. And that issue also features Jessica Drew, which Eric and I will have a plug for at the end of the episode. But focused on this episode, Gina, talk about what we saw out of Rogue here.
Yeah, I mean, I loved it. I think that, you know, the fact that Nightcrawler says to her, you lost two people, really, really hammers it home, because she, you know, even though she had seemingly decided by the end of that episode which of these men she was going to choose or ally herself with, you know, Magneto was the only one, the only man that she was able to ever touch, and losing that is also devastating, even though she had sort of decided this is not a great relationship. But I think especially when you lose sort of the only person you can physically touch and the only person that you've ever like truly loved in the same instance, like some shit's gonna go down. And I love that they didn't shy away from that. I love that she didn't, you know, Rogue has never been one to sort of hold her emotions back. So I love that, to me, it's very in character. you know, Jubilee saying like, why didn't she go to the funeral? It's like, yeah, of course she would not go to the funeral. She's pissed. Like, she doesn't want to stand around somberly and look at his grave being lowered into the ground. She wants to kick some ass. So yeah, I appreciated this. I love when she threw Cap's shield. I thought it was just the right amount of bitchy anger that I want to see from this character for the next, you know, for the time being. And I think it's probably going to hit her even harder when whatever form Gambit does come back in, you know, because there's one very, very dark possibility of who and what he comes back as. I think it's going to like all of this, it's going to just break her.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah, it's going to be more rough times for Rogue. And, you know, she's so worked up and she's so upset and so hurt. Obviously, she's devastated. I mean, Captain America is actually saying, like, well, you know, I can't go down to Mexico dressed like this. He's basically saying, like, I just told you where he is. Go get him. I can't. Oh, I mean, thanks for throwing my shield, bitch.
He's essentially saying what Sunspot's mom said, right? Yeah. Which is like, I support you in private, not in public.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Very good.
Yeah. This uniform doesn't support you, but Steve Rogers does. What are your thoughts on all of this, Brody? And nice eagle eyes on that license plate cameo. I support that.
I loved that they were very cocky inside of the building, and they said, oh, don't worry, this is a Hulk-proof building.
Yeah.
And then Rogue just busted in anyway. Because she's got Ms. Marvel's powers, and that's pretty impressive. Among all, I think she has Avalanche's powers and whoever else. But yeah, they felt confident, like, oh, no one's getting in. And then all of a sudden she was in. I think it's great to see her. And again, as someone who wants Wolverine to be Wolverine, it was nice to see somebody show some anger about what's going on, right? Not crying and whining about it. I understand the sadness. But I'm glad somebody stepped up and said, I need to kick some ass and I need to fix this and do something, because she obviously felt helpless losing the two men in her life at the same time. And, you know, as far as she knows, it was nice to see her be Rogue. I don't think she killed anybody. You know, I mean, if debris fell on them, whatever.
Not until later. But yes, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, well, I don't count him. He was already going. She just helped him. But I did very much like seeing Rogue be Rogue. You know, I feel like that's who Rogue is. And she sort of plays this life of, I fit in and I'm trying to find myself and I'm not, but truthfully, she's deep down. She's a little bit the girl from the Evil Mutants. She's still a little bit of the wild child. So it was nice to see that side of her. I'd like to see it from more of them. So
yeah, It was touched on, but I love the brother-sister dynamic of Nightcrawler and Rogue, which is not something you get a lot of because of how little Nightcrawler we've gotten. Before we talk about the big bads at play, Eric, your thoughts sort of on this arc of Rogue, this quest that she goes on, you know, Death Wish 6 or whatever this would be. I don't know.
Ironically, it would be Death Wish 6, because I looked up recently, there was 5 Death Wishes.
Yeah,
I don't know how or why, but it happened, and now we know. This Rogue, by the way, shows, like, everyone's like, oh, Captain Marvel is tough to put on screen, tough to write, because she has so many powers. When it's like, well, meanwhile, it's like, okay, well, here's Rogue showing all that, and it's fascinating. Because how do you deal with it? Well, you make her unhinged. And all of a sudden, like, she is like the most dangerous mutant out there, and her just busting through like every army in her way is like a non-starter. Like, she destroys them. And ironically, we had just shown my older son Silence of the Lambs. So there's that one moment with like the butterflies and moths.
That was something that I wanted to get to, which is I wanted to ask the question of the audience and the panel. When exactly did Henry Peter Gyrick turn into Jamie Gumb, a.k.a. Buffalo Bill, the serial killer from Silence of the Lambs? He's like carefully curating the butterflies. I'm like, oh, this was missing from the backstory in any iteration of the character. I do like sort of is never a character that I think we were supposed to like. Long before he was in the pages of the X-Men, he was always a dick to the Avengers. Like, he was the one who, he was the representative of the government that said, you can't have seven members. You have to have six. Like, why? Because I said so. All right. So I can't say, well, it's almost like the recent passing of a notorious public figure. People weren't really sad to see that person die. They're not sad to see, like, oh no, but Garrick, you had so much to live for. All right, what happens next? So
I know who you're referencing, and I won't say who, but I saw a recent interview with Cancer, and Cancer said, if I did it, this is how I would have done it.
Thank you for that. Yeah, sure. No one knows who I'm talking about.
No, but whoever it was.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what letters.
Well, Eric, farcical calls notwithstanding, what did you think about, Rogue powering herself into here? Like, I'm going to go get him. And also just, she doesn't give a fuck about anything, Rogue. She's so mad. I mean, she's very focused. I guess that's misspoken. She knows exactly. She's got a singular focus. She doesn't care who gets in her way. She doesn't think of what she has to do, right?
Yeah. When you're asking how many people did she kill? Well, I mean, off camera, it sounded like a fair amount of deaths. In fact, that was one of kind of the most visually interesting moments, was that shot you just previously shown, where it's like we just see the back of him and we see lights flashing and we hear horrifying screams. But then that image you brought up, maybe one of the best quotes of the episode, honey, this ain't that sort of probe. Which I'm not going to try and do her beautiful cadence in capturing that. I was born north of the Mason-Dixon line, so I can't quite pull off that southern lilt. But it was, you're right, it's like she could not give a damn what she did here. And then, of course, that moment at the end where she, you could say, well, she just kind of helped Trask to inevitability, but she sped it up quite a bit by dropping him many stories. Yeah. And
She caught him first in her defense.
She did. Yeah. And then it was like, maybe I shouldn't have.
She actually slowed him down. She gave him another 5 seconds of life.
Yeah. Okay. So I agree. So a lot of
let's look at the positive, Eric. Let's look at the positive.
Yeah, just think about what he got. Think about what he got done in those 5 seconds. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and I don't know if I apologize. I'm jumping to DC, but there was one of the adaptations of The Death of Superman when he came back in those four different forms. The way they revealed one of them was a villain was he had the Toy Master up, like, 50, 60 stories up, and just dropped him to his death and basically said, now say goodbye. And it gave me all the feels of that kind of moment of watching someone who you think is heroic doing something that's pretty evil. Even if it's justified, you're still like, that's where Rogue is now. And that, again, thinking these last few episodes, that's not going to give Rogue the release she needs. She's not going to now feel like, okay, now I feel good. Even if one of the two guys she was involved with is actually not dead, she's still simmering. And I don't know how Cyclops could or Storm could stop her. I do know how, of course, Professor Xavier could.
Yeah, well, that's true. As long as she doesn't, touch that chrome dome of his. But truly evil, of course, is the reveal of Bastion. And I thought that there were some flashes, and I actually thought that we were going to see sort of the Super Sentinel character Nimrod at one point, who was also pink. But this was, a tremendous reveal. And so as we start to kind of wind down with the, I would say untimely demise, but fairly timely demise of both Bolivar Trask and Henry Peter Gyrick and the reveal of Bastion. Gina, where do you think we could possibly be heading after this episode with all of the excitement and reveals and the last few minutes of it?
I think it's interesting because Rogue is probably going to get the blame for that death as well. Since she's the one who put him in a coma and everyone knows that. And obviously no one saw Bastion go in and kill Gyrick. I definitely think I don't want to give too much away because I have some, comics knowledge and things like that, but
sure.
Very clearly, I think the X-Men are going to lose terribly in these last few episodes. I think, whereas sort of in the original series, everything, it all seemed lost. And then in the 11th hour, someone came through, Cable or Bishop or whoever came through. I think this is going to, I think season one is going to end, you know, it's going to sort of Empire Strikes Back us and say like, no, they lost. They are scattered and lost. Bastion is like someone they've never faced before. And also, you know, Bastion is created from essentially and the unkillable and unbeatable Nimrod and, you know, Master Mold. So apologies if people, if your listeners didn't know that, but
no, I think
it's their fault.
Yeah. I think even in the original series, they could never defeat Nimrod. They could only, you know, send him back to the future.
Right.
Or, you know, say like, all right, let's make some decisions while he's putting himself back together. And I think that we will probably get into some time travel shenanigans. I think you don't start a series out having Bishop there if not to remind people that like, hey, time travel exists and we've got, you know, two characters that time travel very frequently. So I think there's going to be some time travel shenanigans and ultimately they're going to lose all over again. Maybe with Genosha playing out a second time.
Yeah. And there's this great line from Morph where after, you know, Rogue just lets Trask fall and he asks the question, is this who we are now? And, I would say, yes, this is actually who you need to be now. Wolverine understands that sometimes this is what needs to be done. And unfortunately, I think they're all starting to learn that. David, is this who the X-Men are now? Is this who they need to be at this moment in X-Men 97?
I think it's who they need to be. But if Morph was so worried, he could have turned into Storm and saved the guy. He didn't exactly, you know, he can shapeshift and now take the power of anybody, which is what Mimic did. Mimic was in this episode.
Right.
Morph can't take anybody's powers unless they're physical powers. Morph can't take mental powers or anything like that.
But he was able to run like Quicksilver is a good example.
Right. He could have run like Quicksilver down the building and then caught him at super speed and lowered him. Morph could have reacted if he wanted to. So he's sitting there like, well, I can't believe we did that. He didn't stop it. So I'm blaming Morph. But yes, I think I
take from Brody.
That's it. Someone's got the guy in the corner over here. He's the guy's. Someone's got to say it. Someone has to say what has to be said. I'm here to defend Thunderbird, and I'm here to put the blame on Morph. He did nothing to stop it. He took out his camera and filmed it. That's what he did.
Hashtag I blame Morph.
Thank you. Yeah, I think
Daniel Drew is saying I got invincible vibes this episode. There was not nearly enough. There was not nearly as much bloodshed.
No one's face looked like putty.
Yeah, no, I had said last week that there was like invincible because
yeah.
2 weeks
flying over the desert. Yeah.
Yeah, and the Shi'ar fight, whatever it is. That fight reminded me of Invincible. I don't know if there was enough. Yeah, there was not enough ripping. And I mean, the fact that she dropped him, had she taken his eyeballs out and ripped his heart out and then dropped him, that would have been more like Invincible. This was.
I'd made a necklace of the eyeballs like a modern day Turk Wendell, which I know has a huge reference for everyone in the audience.
Yes, number 99.
For the two of you, I say it just so that I can laugh. But Eric, I wanted to kind of tie it all together, all of this. And we'll also obviously talk sort of about the very ending. But our friend Kemi Egan referencing Flying Purple People Eater, you know, music placement is one of those things that you really notice when it is very badly done and when it's very well done. This was the latter. I thought it was very funny. It was just like, oh, it's pretty crazy. And I liked it. Your thoughts on all of that, Eric, everything we're talking about, sort of all these reveals that we've gotten along the way.
Yeah, it was a curious song choice, but it definitely gave me some of the vibes. If you remember The Wanderer in the original Children of the Corn, like when that seemingly like innocent pop song, you know, from another era, and it's chilling after you see that movie that scares you. And now Flying Purple People Eater has maybe not quite that level of fear that it instilled in me, but at least I'm not going to dismiss that song again, which for some reason I hear way too much in my life. I don't know why. My kids are old enough. They should know better.
I want to know where you're spending time that you're hearing so much.
I had to DJ a lot of my kids' festivals and stuff. So, that's yes, fair. The shaving moment. I don't know if you have the next picture because it gave me vibes.
I do.
Of a wonderful old school film, Summersby. And it was weirdly a little erotic, dare I say? I don't know. Maybe something about me as a man with beard, that someone shaving my beard, whether I'm a captor or not. There's something a little bit, touchy feely about that.
Sure.
Bringing Magneto back, fun idea. I think, again, not shocking. Any of these characters coming back, not shocking, but definitely he's someone that will be interesting to see how he plays in this whole thing.
Right. I mean, Bastion saying it's the role you were born to play.
Yeah. And he has him obviously under control. So that feels like, all right, well, that's a good weapon for Bastion to use. And yeah, Bastion, I mean, great setup of a villain, giving us little sort of teases of him. But then when he shows up, murders a guy in cold blood in a very unexciting way. I mean, just smothers him with a pillow. I mean, nothing particularly, or I'm sorry, just covers his nose and his mouth. And it's like, well, okay, well, that's a pretty low key way to kill someone when you have powers. But I think that's what's really interesting about this villain, right? Is like, yeah, he's not necessarily giving us his entire bag of tricks right up front. So I'm excited to see where they take Bastion. These last few episodes, they're all linked into him, obviously. So I think they've been very smart how they sort of brought him out when they did. And there's so many question marks still of who's coming back when, how. So now I think they've really set them up for a good sort of final stretch run of the season.
Daniel asking the question that I was wondering, are we going to get a Joseph / Magneto happen? The Joseph iteration of Eric Lenscher of Magneto would certainly be something that I think is at least very possible at this moment. I think we will know by next week at this time. And speaking of next week at this time, next week will be on Thursday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. So make sure to join us when we talk about episode 8. I know we went a little long, but thank you, everyone in the chat and everyone on the panel. Gina, please let everybody know where they can find you. And if they want to continue the conversation about all things X, please let us know where we can find you.
Yeah, you can find me at Gina Ippy on all social media sites that some of them I don't remember exist anymore, like Blue Sky and Threads are still out there.
Threads. We all had that weekend where we all signed up for Threads. Yeah.
Yeah, I get notifications every now and then.
All the time.
Like, what is this? Yeah. This thing? What did I do? And then I write for New Rock Stars right now, and I appear on the Break Room on their Twitch channel. I'll be over there at 3 o'clock today talking about different X-Men stuff as well. Follow New Rock Stars, follow the Break Room, check them out on YouTube and Twitch.
Deep Dive.
And Deep Dive, thank you.
Well, Daniel let us know earlier that the traffic was horrendously slow, so it was okay. Daniel lives in the Washington, D.C. area, and the fact that the traffic is horrendously slow should not surprise anyone. Well, Gina, I can't thank you enough for this. Hopefully, we can try and get you back after the season to see where it all went. And I don't think any of us are prepared for the way the season's going to end because there's too many permutations. We're all Doctor Strange. We can see the 4 million different ways it could happen, but this is going to be the one that does happen. Maybe it's the one where Cable just saves everything, but I don't think so. I don't think they're going to let us off the hook that easily. Well, thank you, Gina. And David Brody, where can you be found?
Well, tagging on to what Gina said about defunct social media platforms, I applied for a job this afternoon before this podcast started with a major company. And at the end, it says, please put in your Facebook URL. And the one below it said, please add your Google Plus URL. No joke.
Did were you able to give them your MySpace and Friendster? Or did
yeah, the ironic thing is this is a major technology company, and that prides itself on social media presence, And it's embarrassing that they have not updated their hiring page asking for my Google, was it Google Plus, right? My Google Plus URL.
I hope you get the job with Stark Industries. You deserve it.
But other than that, on the non-defunct social media platforms, you can find me at David Brody on, I'm still calling it Twitter and Instagram and Threads, I guess, but nobody uses Threads.
I'm on there. I've occasionally thought to post a link to the show on there. And Eric Connor and I will be back for our live audience in 12 minutes. We'll be here on Geekscape for the Geekscape Book Club talking about Spider-Woman Origin by Brian Michael Bendis, sort of giving us the backstory for Jessica Drew that I don't believe existed before that time. And it's a lot of the way people think of the character now. And Gina, you might find this funny. The reason we ended up, that's a monthly show we do. The reason why we're doing a Spider-Woman Jessica Drew story is that I asked everyone I knew, is there a good Madam Web story that we could tell? And they all said, no, you should do something with Spider-Woman.
No, so, the movie did it perfectly.
I'm a fan of her work when it was voiced by Stan Lee's wife in the animated Spider-Man show. So yes,
I 100% am on board for that.
Yeah, I think that's the best iteration.
Yeah, right.
Give us the old crotchety Madam Web that we deserve.
Well, give Dakota Johnson a few years, and that'll be her.
Yeah, she'll be a much better actress by then.
I think so.
Publicity for Madam Web would do it as well. She was not having any of that.
Other than talking with me in a dozen minutes, Eric Connor, where can you be found?
Well, it's important to mention, of course, go Sixers.
Knicks colors.
Nope.
Yeah, you know what? All right, it was good to see you, Eric.
Oh, I'm so sorry to see him go.
All right. You're back.
My sadness and I will be hanging around on X and Instagram over at Count Eric Connor. And if you're in human form in the Burbank area next week, I'm part of a storytelling performance called Home. Mine is focused on a very strange 6 months I spent in Delaware during 2020. So really, I should be saying home, more like the Delco side of me, home. But and Gene, thank you for joining such a wonderful crotchety old man.
Yes, we appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, our friend Nate had car trouble, so there would have been less crotchetiness and less oldness. hopefully we can talk again soon. As always, I can be found at @ChristianDMZ on Twitter, Instagram, and yes, Threads. And of course, my personal podcast, The Bladtcast, BLADTCAST. And Tuesdays at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, over on the Who Are These Podcasts YouTube channel. Who Are These Broadcasters? And boy, do we have somebody delightful to introduce people to. Thanks to Eric turning me on to Crackhead Barney, I believe is her name, right?
Yeah, it's my second cousin.
It seems like it, but we went long. That's more than all the time we have for now. So as the great Stan Lee would say, Excelsior!
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.